Hi, I'm Stefan Duccio. I'm the cinematographer on The Invisible Man, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions, and this is the Go Creative Show, a podcast for filmmakers. Today's episode is all about how to light and shoot the invisible. Yes. You heard me right. We've got Stefan Duccio, the director of photography for The Invisible Man, on today. And we have a really interesting discussion about how he approached the film. Particularly some topics that I loved is he talked a lot about unmotivated camera movement. And of course, we dive pretty deep into the technical issues he had to overcome for scenes in The Invisible Man, because they wanted to do a lot of stuff practically. They wanted to do a lot of the action scenes in a single take. And of course, how do you do that when one of your characters is invisible and there's things flying all over the room and you have a woman being thrown up against a wall and tossed on the floor and dragged all over the place by something that's invisible? So we talk a lot about the visual effects that went into that and how the film's director and, of course, Stefan as well, really tried to make this look as practical as possible. And personally, I think they got the job done. Go Creative Show is supported by PostLab, stress-free collaboration for Final Cut Pro 10, and Rule Boston Camera by Rent Create at rule.com. I want to encourage you guys to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. And follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, particularly because we give you guys an opportunity to have your question heard on the show. So let's dive right in, shall we? There's a lot to talk about with Stefan Duccio, the director of photography for The Invisible Man. So I'm here with Stefan Duccio. He is the director of photography for The Invisible Man, the 2020 remake of the 1933 classic. Although, you know, I shouldn't even say remake because it seems like it's not at all similar, other than there's a character that's invisible. But thank you so much for being on the show, Stefan.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited to be with you.
I didn't see the original, but I didn't even know that there was an Invisible Man movie before. But now, like in prep, learning about this upcoming film, your work, I kind of looked at the old 1933 trailer, and it's so funny to look at old movie trailers. It's hilarious.
It's great. I haven't seen the trailer, actually. I'd love to see it. But no, I've watched parts of the original. And you're right, as you said, it's nothing like the original. And I think to the point where Lee Whannell, our writer-director, has been given an original story credit or something to that effect to distinguish it a little bit more from the original because he's just changed it so much. But yeah, I'd love to see that trailer.
Oh my God, it's just so good. You know what's weird? It's like whenever I see old trailers like that, it's weird. It's like, yes, obviously the dialect is dated, the cadence that people speak is dated. But it's like you'll look at stuff and you'll say, you'll almost be amazed with how they even got anything done without having any of the technologies that we do today. It's always impressive to me when you see that because they still did do like these, you know, tricks where he would, the Invisible Man would unwrap his head and body from this like a cloth that went around him to define his shape. And, you know, he's invisible underneath. And yes, it's obviously like cheesy old effects, but it's impressive that any of that stuff gets done when you look at old films.
Absolutely. I mean, whenever I see making ofs of even films from the 60s and 70s, and I'm blown away by the ingenuity by special effects and visual effects teams back then. And I think we've got it, well, I have it so much easier. I'm sure the visual effects departments these days don't think so much. But I'm blown away by the in-camera effects that used to be achieved.
It's really crazy. It really is nuts to look at that.
Yeah.
It's like, because nowadays you look at something, you're like, I don't know how they did it, but I know a computer did it. But then you look back then, you're thinking, wait a minute, how did they frame that? Like, how did they light for that? It really is, it's cool to look at that old stuff. Did you watch I know you said you saw a couple of clips from The Invisible Man, but was the original Invisible Man like at all part of the prep for this?
Do you know what it wasn't? I kind of wish it was in a way. We did watch a whole other bunch of movies, but we didn't watch much of the original. I spoke about a little bit with Lee, but now he digressed so much from the original story that I guess we didn't feel the need to delve into it too much.
Yeah, one of our Instagram followers, Seth Herzog, sorry if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, he kind of wanted to know how much was the visual language of the original movie an influence. Sounds like it wasn't at all.
Not so much. I mean, maybe I can let you know some of the movies Lee and I watched.
Yeah, what did you watch?
Lee screened to me, we watched again Hereditary. He absolutely loves Hereditary.
How great is that?
Yeah, and we rewatched The Exorcist together, which was really inspiring. It's funny, the things Lee tends to screen to us during pre-production are more films that he just adores the filmmaking and the craft of, not so much a direct influence in a way, but just touchstones of films that inspire him. Myself, on the other hand, I showed him a couple of films that I love from recent years that I thought tonally could suit the world that we were playing in. One big one for me was Prisoners, which is
absolutely.
It's by Denis Villeneuve, and Roger Deakins shot it. It was like one of the first one of their first collaborations together. It's got Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal. I think it's 2013. It might have come
look
out.
At this. You know what? I didn't see it, but the poster is familiar. I'm looking at it right now.
It's an incredible film. It's so beautifully shot, and it's full of so much dread. Like the camera movement in it is so haunting, and that's influenced me ever since I've seen that film. And obviously, I love everything Roger's done with Denis since then, like Sicario and Blade Runner. But I often rewatch Prisoners for films like this. And we also watched Personal Shopper together. That film, I think it won Cannes Film Festival about 3 years ago with Kristen Stewart. And she played a medium in Paris who was still felt the presence of her brother. And she remained in Paris to try and uncover whether her brother was still there, who was her deceased twin. Mm. And again, that film was filled with these haunting images of emptiness. That I thought really suited The Invisible Man. What else did we watch?
Well, it sounds like the theme is this kind of like haunting sorrow, kind of gloomy, dark mood. Tell us about what the Invisible Man is about.
So it centers on a woman named Cecilia, played by Elizabeth Moss. And the film begins with her escaping an elaborate escape from her boyfriend's mansion. And it's a very tense escape in the middle of the night. And it's about her subsequently trying to put her life back together weeks afterwards, after she escapes. And, you know, without spoiling too much, it's revealed very early in the film that her boyfriend commits suicide, and that she's got nothing more to worry about. And she can come out of the shadows, and she doesn't have to worry about being pursued by her abusive ex-partner. But it doesn't go so smoothly for her. But one thing I really love about the script that Lee wrote is that when the first time I read it, throughout it, you're really questioning whether any of this is really happening to Cecilia or not. And Elizabeth really pulls that off to the point where, you know, you can play these amazing point of views off Elizabeth's face, and we're really hoping the audience questions whether is there someone in the room with her, or is she totally imagining this? And that's really in the script that Lee wrote too. Like, page by page, you're really questioning, hang on, I think she's just going crazy here, or maybe someone is really there. So that's the beauty of the script.
I love that. And there's something just so like intrinsically human about that frustration that you feel when someone doesn't believe you. Like it could be the simplest thing, but when you say something to someone and you know it's true and they don't believe you and you can't prove it, It's like the most frustrating thing in the world. And it can make you crazy. Yeah. You know what I mean? It can make you insane. And I think taking that idea to the heights that this film is, that this film does, I mean, it really does make it to a point where you just don't know what's true and what isn't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. And that plays across many scenes in the film where her close friends don't believe what's happening to her.
Can you tell me the prep process, the pre-production process that you go through when you get a script? Like, what is the first step? And you can speak in general terms, or you can direct it specifically to this film. But where do you begin in your process?
It's different every time for me, and I kind of feed off the director's energy a lot. I tend to enjoy not getting too specific too early. I always fumble a little bit when directors ask me immediately after I've read a script, what should the film look like, or, you know, what do we think we can do with this?
So they jump on you right away, huh?
A little bit, and they have every right to, I guess, because often the time it might be a job interview, so they kind of want to hear, okay, you've read the script. What do you envision for this film?
Yeah.
I hesitate a little bit with that because I feel like it's a lot more of a slow burn for me. I kind of need to get to know the director more. I need to get to know the script more, and I tend to like to talk about story mostly in those early days and weeks before delving into the visuals as much, because I feel like the visuals will come naturally and inherently after getting to know the director and the story more. So often I like to spend time with the director. Obviously, your location scouting a lot in those early days. So I like to watch films with them if possible. Doesn't even have to be whole films. Like, we can just sort of screen Blu-rays to each other and play our favorite scenes from things that we think might be relevant. Mm. You know, we look at photography together, sometimes painting. I've done things on some projects before where I'll create like a little private Tumblr blog where I'll just put everything up on it from, say, newspaper articles about things that are relevant to the film we're making, to, you know, photography, trailers, my own location scouting photos. And sometimes I do it in a blog format because you might be away on an away job, and you might not have a centralized production office where you can put on a wall hundreds of photos. So that's sort of the digital equivalent of a mood board. You know, I explore websites a lot. Film Grab, or where I look at screen grabs of films. I often print. Probably for The Invisible Man, I did a lot of photographic printing, and I remember making two photo boards in the director's office. One photo board was stills and photography that inspired both Lee and I, and another photo board was purely our location scouting stills. So it was interesting having kind of inspiration and reality kind of next to him about, okay, here's what we aspire to be, and here's the reality of what our locations are actually looking like.
Yeah.
And I love printing. I kind of learned photographic printing at university, and I love the physicality of printing our photos, and it kind of means every time you're sitting in the director's office for a meeting, everyone's kind of just glancing at that, and it's kind of reminding everybody what the film will look like. You know, it could be the director talking to actors or production designer or the art department producers, but everyone has that kind of constant reminder of what the film aspires to be.
I'm surprised that you're developing that during the location scout. I think you go into the scout kind of already knowing what you want the film to look like.
Well, I guess for me, the scouting often, it can run for weeks, and it can lead up to, you know, a week or two before production starts. So for me, the scouting is often a moving feast. And I reprint, I take things off the wall that the director might not like, and I put new pictures up. But yeah, often I wish the scouting stopped a lot earlier, but in reality, it continues to go, continues to move.
Now, if you're sort of developing the look of the film throughout this process that you're talking about, you're hanging out with the director a little bit, you're doing the scout. Do you, like, in situations where you don't have that luxury and you're not just going to get the job based on, you know, your past experience or relationships that you have, what if you actually have to go and present your ideas in order to get the job? Like, how do you handle that?
Well, I've had to do that a couple of times where I might, that a director might be interviewing several cinematographers.
Yeah.
And so maybe to help my chances, I'll do a bit of a visual treatment for the film. And it's that fine line between presenting ideas that you think could be great for the film, but you also want to be careful not to overstep push something too hard in that document, because a director might be like, they might not be so into how forthright you are with that idea. It's a fine line. And I guess I've seen a lot of directors' treatments for advertising.
Yeah.
And so I've seen some very good presentations in that world, and I kind of know how to present ideas from that world. I've often had to do that too. I mean, I kind of enjoy that process too, because it does force you to dig deep very early on and go, wow, what could I do with this film? And I didn't have to do that with Invisible Man because of my past experiences with Lee.
Yeah.
But I've had to do that a couple of times.
I saw an interview with you talking about your pre-production process, and it seems extensive, because you had mentioned that oftentimes you'll end up with like 10,000 photos of something leading into a film. You were talking about making previs for some of the scenes, and it just seems like you do a lot of work in pre-production. Do you feel that you're doing a lot of work, or is this just kind of normal for you? Or, you know, I don't know I don't necessarily know what's normal. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I don't necessarily know what's normal either, because I haven't had a chance to like sit on the shoulder of many cinematographers before and seen their process.
Yeah.
But it feels necessary for me. It's kind of, I'm hungry for information in the pre-production process, and I kind of use up every minute I've got. So on The Invisible Man, I did take thousands of stills, but it's mainly location scouting stills. And I've got like a huge Lightroom library where I arrange every scout into different folders and narrow it all down. And from those stills, I might make photo boards with the director. For example, on The Invisible Man, we had a very elaborate opening sequence where Cecilia escapes this amazing house.
Yeah.
And that house was sort of a mix of maybe three or four different locations. So to help Lee and I visualize that, we photoboarded that with stand-ins, or one stand-in really, because it was just Elizabeth Moss, and arranged that as a PDF and printed it out or put it on our iPads. And it helped us link the locations together visually. And it also helped us communicate to our, AD, our visual effects supervisor, producers, how it's all going to work as a sequence. And for those kind of elaborate sequences, I find it really necessary. There was a few sequences like that in Invisible Man where either we photoboarded it, or if it was quite extensive, where there is another big action set piece in the middle of the film where I shot it all on a Canon 5D, videoed it. We cut that together. And again, that helped us communicate to multiple departments, because it was one of those sequences where many people were hungry for information, from stunts to visual effects to ADs, gaffers and grips. Everyone needed to know what was happening across this entire week of kind of night shooting in the rain. And between a previs, overhead maps of the scene and photo boards, we kind of needed to do that. And I've kind of built up that kind of work flow over the years. I probably didn't always do that, but after having been maybe burnt a couple of times on where you may have run out of time and you felt you could have done more if everybody on the crew knew what we were trying to achieve more. You know, you might have gotten a few more setups out of the night or the day if communication was better. So I guess I've kind of started developing these techniques in pre to help with all that.
I love that. I'm a huge proponent for extensive pre-production and pre-vises. I was thinking about maybe even releasing my pre-vis work for commercials just to like show it as like a behind the scenes kind of thing, because I find it fascinating when you see a pre-vis video or even just a collection of stills and what that eventually turned into. I mean, I do that all the time. Granted, I do commercials, so, you know, the timing has to be perfect. You have to know something's going to fit within 30 seconds. So pre-vis for me is like super, super important. But I'm considering like actually posting. If any of you guys listening would be interested in any of that, let me know, because I have pre-vises for a whole bunch of our work. And I just love that whole thing. So no need to belabor on the idea of pre-vis. We've got a question from Janwaz on Instagram that I love, which is, what was the first technical issue you thought about after reading the script?
I guess obviously, how do you shoot someone who's not in the room? And at times in the film, Elizabeth's character, Cecilia, has to interact with this invisible man, or objects in the room have to interact with the invisible man. And so I immediately thought of motion control, I guess, after I read the script. Hmm. And for those people who haven't worked with motion control, it allows you to move the camera in a repeatable manner once you've programmed the move into the motion control robot. So if we want to track, you know, Cecilia across the room, left to right for 15 feet, you know, we can do that, and it will, perfectly repeat that move again and again and again. So it means we can shoot a shot in a kitchen and dining room, for example, with Elizabeth Moss walking across a room, and then we will take Elizabeth out, and then we can get a clean plate of that same room. We can also get another setup of that same shot with objects in the room moving, or, the invisible man interacting with Cecilia. We might need to do 10 plates of that one shot, and it makes, you know, our visual effects department's life a lot easier to be able to have those moves repeatable. It makes the visual effects better. If I were to do that shot handheld, for example, you know, it would be an absolute nightmare for them to layer all that up. Possible, like, you know, anything's possible, of course, but we just, you know, I just knew, I guess, after reading the script that this film would have needed an extensive amount of motion control work.
So was Elizabeth Moss interacting with anyone on set at all?
Yeah, a lot. We play it shot by shot. So again, the previs situation helped, because when we'd previs something, we would present that video to our visual effects supervisor, Jonathan Deering, and some shots were obvious where you'd be like, okay, she needs to get thrown across the room here. She's going to be on a mix of a harness and a wire rig, and a man in a green suit will also need to pick her up and throw her. So yeah, there's shots like that where you're like, absolutely. There's other times though when you thought, well, if we put a man in a green suit interacting with Elizabeth in this frame, he's going to ruin Elizabeth's performance too much, because his arms will inevitably get in her face or across her body, and it'll be very difficult to recreate her face or body again. So some shots you'd be like, okay, Elizabeth will mime that scenario. And yeah, in the previs, we would mark up on every shot. We'd like, right, motion control, you know, in the bottom of the screen, or miming, or whatever technique we may have needed to use.
Plus, I can imagine if you have a visible person in the shot, you kind of will break the performance also, because she's not supposed to see anything. And I think it's only natural that if there were something to look at, her eye line may be directed there. I don't know. It seems like it would be better to not have anything in the room at times.
Totally. Probably like 80% of the time there was nobody there, you know, that she had to interact with, and it was all her performing to the room. But there's times where we needed to, yeah, have her interact.
She's such a great actor. Like, she's so good.
Yeah, she's phenomenal. And yeah, it blew me away after, you know, the first day, because I was like, okay, we all need to be on our A game. Take one is amazing, like every time.
Wow.
You know, we've got to all be on our marks, all be ready, because she's not going to work up to it. Take one was amazing every day. So yeah, it was a real pleasure to watch her work.
Let's take a quick break and talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment for a couple of different reasons. One, Rule understands that production is mission critical. They understand that. They understand that every minute on a production is costing somebody a lot of money, and they want to make sure that there is no downtime due to problems with gear. They just don't want that to happen. So when you rent equipment from Rule, they make sure that you completely understand what it is. Plus, you get really good quality stuff. Now, I don't know if some of you guys have rented equipment from other production houses, and you may know, or other rental houses, and you may get it, and it's a little busted up, it's a little used, maybe a little bit dirty. Never the case with Rule Boston Camera. They meticulously care for the equipment they have, and they take pride in it. So when you get equipment out from them, you're getting really good quality stuff in excellent condition, and they make sure you understand it before you take it out. Okay, they're also committed to supporting you the entire time you have their equipment on your set. So we're talking about peace of mind. Now, they wouldn't be anything if they didn't have an amazing inventory. And after over 35 years in business, you can imagine what they have. Cameras, audio, lighting, grip gear, communications, dynamics, everything you want, they have it. And that's why I continue to use them. And that's why big, giant Hollywood shows and movies that come through Boston also use Rule Boston Camera. So you should be doing it too. Check them out for yourself at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. Let's break down just for a couple minutes the scene in the kitchen where she gets choked and thrown against the wall and all this stuff's going on.
Yep.
Can you walk us through kind of how you shot the plates for that, how they were layered, a little bit more about the camera movement? I'd just love to know how you kind of broke down that scene.
Yeah. So as Lee and I talked about that scene more and more, we liked the idea of having it play out as one long unbroken take. It just felt like by letting it play out longer and having the camera slowly float around the room more, it would encourage the audience to look around the room more to try and discover where the Invisible Man was rather than doing it amongst a series of quick cuts. Mm. It also felt like the easy way out to do it in a series of quick cuts, and it would maybe make it feel less threatening. You know, there's something more haunting about having the camera impersonally float around the room while this horrible thing is happening to her. So once we decided it needed to be one long unbroken take in pre-production, you know, we started working with our stunt coordinator, Harry Duncanalis. And I'd worked with Harry a lot before in commercials, and he'd recently invested in an Argo motion control robot as well, like a couple of years earlier. And I'd also worked with that. So I kind of recommended Lee work with him on this film because he could be a bit of a triple threat to us in a way, because he could work on our fight scenes and stunt coordinate. And he could also help manage the motion control work in the film. And he also had a studio in Sydney that we could work out of to do all these rehearsals. So it was very handy in pre-production to be able to visit this studio with Harry and do rehearsals with his stunt team. And we kind of taped up in his studio the layout of the kitchen as our production designer, Alex, was envisioning it. And we would just work it out. One restriction we had is that the motion control robot basically works on 1 6-meter piece of track. So that track can't be curved or bent, or, and it can't even be shorter. So we kind of had to design the kitchen and living room around this 1 6-meter piece of track. and design the fight around the track in a way. So that was a real restriction in a way. But it also kind of worked as well. So
I'm actually kind of surprised that you didn't, I'm surprised that you had all that figured out before the set was created. I would think the set would be created and then you'd be like, oh shit, we can only, we have to make this thing a little bit bigger or smaller.
Yeah, no, thankfully it was all kind of happening simultaneously together in the early weeks where we were like, okay, has to be motion control. And the second we figured out we needed to build James's house, which is the house where Cecilia hides away in. And we made sure, you know, hallways were big enough to contain a dolly and motion control, and walls could be taken apart where we needed to be. Yeah. We knew the house needed to get trashed a bit. So yeah, we kind of worked it out over weeks with Harry, and then Harry would shoot it on like a little Sony camera. And, you know, initially Lee really wanted to do it as one long unbroken take on the day. But to Harry's urging, he urged Lee to break it up into different parts. So, you know, we could be putting Elizabeth on a harness at points. At some points, Elizabeth didn't need one, so she would just be struggling. And we would have all these kind of seamless blends throughout. So in the final film, it's all one seamless shot. But, you know, practically on the day, it was probably broken up into three or four passes, I think.
Wow, that is so cool. I love that stuff.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. It was really exciting.
So you've got, so when people are watching that scene, you're blending four-ish, you know, three or four performances into one single take.
Yep.
That is fascinating.
Can't pick it. Yeah.
So were there different layers to the shooting? So I know you're getting four performances from Elizabeth, but like, did you do an empty plate and then one with, you know, one movement and then one with the other movement? How did you layer them?
Yeah. There might have been 20 plates to it, for example, probably more. Like, well, once I speak to the visual effects supervisor, he could probably tell you how many. But, you know, because we also needed objects to fly around the room as well.
Yeah,
like a table goes flying across the room, a curtain goes flying. So we would do a plate just for the table, you know, where they would pull that on a cable from the ceiling. Or we would do a plate of the curtain, a plate for Elizabeth, a plate of the empty room, plate of Elizabeth getting lifted in the air. So yeah, many, many different parts to it.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that stuff. Yeah. I want to talk about, I want to talk about lighting a little bit with you. So was there anything that you had to accommodate for in your lighting? Because one of the main characters was invisible. How did that change the way that you lit these scenes?
Well, one thing Lee impressed upon me early on was that he's been involved in a lot of horror movies. And, you know, I've done some darker thrillers myself. And so he really pushed the idea of, look, even when she turns the lights on, this movie should still be scary because he could still be in the room. You don't need darkness for this film to be scary. In bright daylight, he could be there, which is a really interesting idea. So on that front, we did endeavor to have it brighter in whenever possible. Yeah, there are some dark scenes in the room, in the film. But that was probably the biggest challenge for me, how to still give the film mood and shape and a haunting feel while with the lights on.
How'd you do it?
Color contrast probably really helped. So for example, you know, it might have been a coolly minty green fluorescent in the kitchen mixed with tungsten in the lounge room, and that still helped give contrast to the image. You know, it wasn't all kind of flat and warm. I still had to have areas of darkness to give it some shape, but it was an interesting challenge. I feel like shot by shot, I struggled with it at times. And Lee was always like, you're taking the easy way out. Like, it's too dark. Let's go brighter.
Wow. So he was pushing you to brighten it up.
Yeah. It's really interesting. It's funny because often directors are saying the opposite. They're always wanting it darker and darker. And I feel like as a cinematographer, you might be wanting to expose things a little bit safer and, pushing it darker in the DI. But on the day, he was wanting brighter and brighter scenes. But in saying that, there's a lot of dark scenes in the film, and we choose our battles. There's particular sequences in the film where we play up the brightness, and some sequences where she's in an attic, for example, where it's only lit by a torch.
Now, were there things that you had to do in the scenes where the Invisible Man was clearly there? Did you do anything from a lighting standpoint to help support that?
No, not particularly. Like, we wanted the audience to constantly question whether he was really there or not. And if anything, the camera movement was much more seductive in that way. So,
how do you mean?
We kind of wanted the camera to feel like it always knew more than Elizabeth knew, or more than the audience knew. So we have a lot of unmotivated camera movement throughout the film. So, for example, early in the film when Elizabeth's escaping, her partner's mansion, she's getting some things ready in the kitchen, and the camera kind of omnisciently just sort of pans away from her without any motivation and just lands on a very moody, empty hallway, and it just sits there looking at this hallway. Hmm. And you assume the whole audience is just waiting for him to walk out from the end of the hallway or to see him appear, but nothing happens, and the camera very slowly pans back to her. And there's a whole series of haunting shots like that throughout the movie that just sort of leave Elizabeth in an unmotivated way and suggest to the audience somebody's there. And so we're hoping that creates a lot of tension in the film. And
I love that concept of unmotivated movement in the camera knowing more than the main character. That's a really interesting concept that I don't think we've really talked about much on this show or at all. I can't recall any moment like that, but that's really interesting.
I felt like we hit upon something there, because I guess one thing as a camera operator you're often trying to do is follow your instincts and follow the actors and make everything motivated. Yeah. Everything's kind of motivated off the actor's eye lines and what they're doing. Whereas one thing that was kind of interesting on this was fighting against those instincts and maybe framing Elizabeth very hard in the corner of the room. Or, there's a scene where she's being interrogated by a police officer, and during dialogue, we just rack focus through Elizabeth into the corner of the room behind her on emptiness. And it felt so strange doing that on the day, to like put your lead actress out of focus and just sort of pan off them during performance. But we're hoping these moments create a real feeling of unease, and hoping it engages the audience, because it should encourage them to search the corners of the frame, because sometimes things do happen in the corners of the frame on the film. And I've seen it with the audience a couple of times, and I think half the people see it and half don't, which is great, I think, because it encourages active viewership.
It seems like a lot of this movie was filmed practically. I certainly see a lot of practical lights in the scenes.
Yep.
Seems like a lot of the, when I look at behind the scenes clips, it looks like you're, not relying on visual effects as much as I think a lot of films are these days. Talk to me about the decision to do that and where it came from and your thoughts on it.
I guess I feel like it's a growing movement among filmmakers, isn't it? That we all are loving getting effects more and more in camera these days. I've read a lot about how The Mandalorian, for example, used an LED wall And captured so much of that in camera. I mean, it's amazing. And so in a very smaller way, when we built James's house on stage in Fox Studios in Sydney, rather than surround the house in green screens, we explored having photographic prints out the window. And then for one of our featured windows, we rear projected a background using two 4K projectors and had a background played out that window, which was so exciting because it meant that light affected the window.
Yeah.
And it meant that I could shoot characters against the window and have it all in camera. It also meant visual effects didn't have to worry about bad edges of green screen on translucent curtains. It meant I didn't have to have that anxiety about coverage on a shoot day where sometimes, producers might grumble if you've got the green screen in shot again and again and again and again, because it just means a huge amount of compositing for them. Whereas I thought having a rear projection meant Lee and I could shoot a scene however we would like without that hanging over us.
You're really seeing a lot of that rear projection more and more now, and having, being able to use the light from your backgrounds as much as possible. In fact, we did an episode with Baz Eidoin, the cinematographer for The Mandalorian. We have a huge discussion in that episode about that LED screen that he used. And it's just becoming more and more popular. It just seems so expensive, though. Like, it seems like it's going to be cost prohibitive.
Yeah, I guess for the right production, it works, like The Mandalorian. I actually spoke to Greg Fraser when we were in pre-production on The Invisible Man and asked his advice, because I'd heard a rumor that he'd used something to that effect. I didn't appreciate at the time when I asked him how much it was going to, how much they used it in The Mandalorian. But he impressed upon me how important it was for them, because it was an actual light source for them, and the color and feel of that background plate affected their foreground. We had that in a smaller way because it was projection, not LED, so it didn't affect our room as much. It has a little effect. And I could also put the camera outside of our set looking into it, and it cast beautiful reflections across all the windows. So that was a real discovery for me, that having real reflections over all the windows felt very real for being in studio. And I hadn't done a lot of studio work to that extent before. I've done, smaller studio work, or I've done a lot of commercials in studio, but to make a very realistic house interior in studio, I had a bit of anxiety about, and so I really wanted it to feel as real as possible, and I didn't want to rely on too many studio tricks, like too much top light, for example.
Yeah.
I wanted to motivate a lot of light from the windows as much as possible. And
from practicals. Yeah. I mean, it looks like like you've got a lot of scenes where the light seems to be really just from practical lights. I mean, I'm sure you probably added something to kick in for Phil, but I mean, it looks pretty natural.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely. A lot of practicals in shot. I probably had little things off the side hiding where I could, just to throw that practical light a little bit further. But it's really fun.
What are those rear projections projecting on? What is the material?
The material, I'm not sure exactly, but I assume it's very similar to cinema screen. We engaged a projection company in Sydney called TDC, and they do a lot of big corporate events, and they also manage very big large-scale projection on the Sydney Opera House every year for a big festival called Vivid Festival. And so they project from as far away as the Sydney Harbour Bridge all the way to the Opera House and
Jesus.
Put colours on the sails. So for us, we were kind of a little bit of a smaller fry job for them.
Yeah.
They were able to set up those cinema screens, and my key grip was able to put them on wheels, which was fantastic, because it just meant I could have, say, a 40-foot screen and just wheel it around depending on what our background, what my angle of my camera angle was. The only tricky thing, of course, that I didn't have was parallax shift, I guess. So when I did move the camera, I couldn't go too crazy with camera movement because the parallax of that screen wouldn't change, of course. So, I was fortunate that our coverage was never that dynamic, I guess, when it was looking into that screen. It was quite simple.
So wait, hold on. But wouldn't it parallax, like if you're looking out a window, let's say, and yep. your screen goes well beyond the boundaries of the window, why wouldn't it parallax? Like why wouldn't you get, I mean, you're not going to get the same amount, but you'd get a little bit.
Exactly. It gets a little bit.
So what does that just get enhanced later on?
No, it was what it was, I guess. Like, you know, because we put props in front of the screen as well. Like we might've put bushes or a lamppost or we had a real porch. All of those things helped create parallax. So then the screen was 40 feet beyond those things. So we had, subtle parallax from that screen in the distance.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I haven't had any experience with that. I mean, what I've done is just have like green screen out the windows or something and then have to put it in visually afterwards. But then you have all the green bleed and it just doesn't look as good. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And, it's just not as much fun, I guess, either.
Yeah.
I guess it obviously gives you a lot of freedom. You can change that plate as to your heart's desire and, you know, everyone can decide on what that background is later. But it was really fun to achieve that on the day.
I want to talk to you guys about an amazing offer to get 3 free months of PostLab simply by going to gocreativeshow.com/PostLab. Now, what is PostLab? Well, it's a collaboration tool for Final Cut Pro 10. It enables you to share libraries, track and save changes, and make sure that no more than one person is working on the library at the same time. So you're going to get 0 conflicts plus a recallable history of your project. Now, anybody using Final Cut Pro 10 knows that yes, you can collaborate with it, and we do it all the time, but it's a little bit of a sore spot with that application. It is no longer a problem with PostLab. This is a game-changing application that you guys need to explore for yourself. Now, PostLab is the best of both worlds. It's in part a cloud service that has a cloud purposefully built for Final Cut Pro 10 libraries, so they will not break. And then the other part is that it's also a desktop app. So you always have a full local copy of your production. So you don't have to be connected to PostLab's cloud or even the internet at all to work on your library, which is great. So you really don't have to change your edit workflow. The only thing this does is it just changes and simplifies your collaboration workflow. And that's exactly what we need as Final Cut Pro 10 editors. Within the production, collaborators can set up and assign tasks. They can comment on changes and set statuses on libraries. It goes on and on and on. And the best part is you get 3 months of it free by going to gocreativeshow.com/PostLab. So head over there, enjoy it, love it. I know you guys will become obsessed with it, especially if you're doing collaboration with Final Cut Pro 10. This is the tool we have been waiting for, and it is finally here. PostLab, 3 months free at gocreativeshow.com/PostLab. Let's talk about your camera package on the film. What did you shoot on and how many cameras?
We had 3 camera bodies for the shoot and we were on the Alexa LF and we were very fortunate that we got one of the prototype Alexa Mini LFs sent out straight from Munich, I think, to us. I think they were very rare at the time when we were shooting in mid-2019.
Yeah.
And I was very excited to get a Mini LF because it meant we could put that camera body on our motion control robot. It meant we could use it for all our Steadicam and handheld work.
Did you love it?
I absolutely loved it. Yeah. It's an incredible camera. And, I was on the Arri Signature Primes as well. And so having been and still am a huge admirer of Roger Deakins' work, you know, and I saw and Prisoners being a great touchstone for me. I love the look he created with that on the master primes. And for me, I felt like the signature primes were the kind of large format equivalent of those. Mm. Albeit there, I feel like they're a little bit smoother. And, you know, I felt pretty strongly about that camera package and those lenses when I read the script. I knew it was a very modern thriller. It needed a very contemporary look. I feel like I'd been doing a lot of work on kind of vintage glass and anamorphic glass in recent years, and I was kind of hungry to play with something more modern. And I felt like Lee had written such a tense modern script. I thought, let's lean into that. Lee needed a little bit of convincing. Like, we did a bunch of camera tests.
Convincing from what? What was he?
Of the format, really. I think he was a little bit nervous to go so clean and so modern. Because our previous film, Upgrade, we'd shot on E-series and C-series Panavision anamorphics. And so, you know, I kind of needed to show him a few different looks, which is fine. I do that on most films, like just showing directors some different lenses, lens packages. We project them in a room. We look at them together. But I'm glad he agreed, because I just feel like they were perfect for this film.
Yeah, there's this clean, crisp kind of look to the film, but there's also a little bit of like creamy softness in there too. And I know that people listening are like, you just said two completely opposite things, but no, but it's like, but I feel like, especially at the beginning when you're in, Adrian's house, like the house is so modern. There's like LEDs, there's LED strips, like in that garage area where she's dealing with the dog. And like, there's this crisp, modern, almost futuristic look that lends itself to this very clean kind of cinematography. But when you take that approach to the kind of regular world, you know, her normal world, and in James's house, the texture of the art direction gives it a softness too. And I thought the blend was really, really cool. I loved it.
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm glad. I mean, you've just hit the nail on the head with that description, because that's exactly what we're going for. Very clean, modern world for Adrian's house. And then at James's house, it's warmer, softer, a lot more texture to the art direction. The walls have more texture. There's more clutter. There's more color. Whereas it's quite monochromatic and cool in Adrian's house.
But was your camera and lens package the same for both? Like, did you have one lens package consistent throughout the whole film?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We just had one set of signature primes, which we shared across, you know, two cameras. And yeah, probably that creamy look you're mentioning may have been imbued in the DI a little bit more. Mm. The lenses definitely render the world a little bit cleaner, but in the DI, I kind of worked with this wonderful colorist, Tom Poole, who's at Company 3, and he has a deep love of photography and printing. And so he often talked about the feel of a photographic print and how the highlights are creamy in prints and, you know, the shadow details always a bit more lifted. And I am, I'm probably a little bit more traditional, I guess, in that I always love seeing my black level really black and want to see really deep blacks. But he encouraged me to look at this film a bit differently and give it a bit more of a creamier look to it and a bit more of a printier photographic look. And I didn't necessarily go into that DI thinking I wanted to get that out of it, but I was just so in love with what he was offering up throughout that process that I completely leaned into it. It just felt so photographic and film-like, what he was doing with color. That I loved it. I felt like it was a great juxtaposition to the signature primes. They kind of played off each other really well.
Did you get to monitor any of that look on set as you were shooting?
No. So it works a little bit differently in Australia. I mean, I'm sure some cinematographers on larger productions in Australia work with an on-set DIT, but I kind of generally have one LUT and that I kind of work on in pre-production and then have that in the camera throughout the whole shoot. And then on wrap every day, I would spend time with my DIT, Christopher Rieg, for maybe half an hour to an hour every day, and look at the day's footage with him and make further tweaks to the day's footage. You know, he might need to balance some day exteriors, for example, or I may have, for a dark scene in particular, I always tend to expose those a bit healthier and then grade them down a little bit more with the DIT. Things like that, you know, and so I don't necessarily look at it on the day, but I try and get the director the closest looking footage for his edit as possible so they don't, you know, suffer from offline syndrome where they're looking at images that aren't as well graded. And I know in the States, you guys tend to have on-set DITs a little bit more and you're doing that on set, but for whatever reason, I find that a little bit distracting. Maybe I haven't worked with it in the right way yet, but I feel like I've got a lot going on set. And if I had to get that specific with the color at the speed we're working at, it might slow things down for me a little bit.
Mm. Did you have any filters in front of your lenses?
No, just traditional kind of NDs I used. I don't know if I ever used a polarizer even. It was just very simple on that front.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm noticing that The Invisible Man has an IMAX release, which has got to be exciting for you. And I'd love to know, you know, how your camera choice fit into this. Like, did you know it was going to be released in IMAX?
We didn't know, but I'm insanely excited about seeing our work in an IMAX theater. We're very fortunate we shot on the Alexa LF, which IMAX deemed and Universal deemed capable of doing an IMAX finish on. You know, I assume if I shot it on a normal Alexa, they might not have allowed it. But it's a major vote of confidence by Universal and Blumhouse that they're happy enough with the film to master it for that. So, yeah, I mean, the signature primes hold up beautifully.
Have you seen it on an IMAX screen yet?
I haven't. I've seen some tests. I've seen some tests for it. And our director and editor supervised a lot of that process. Unfortunately, we didn't compose for a taller aspect ratio of IMAX. So yeah, it's still being mastered in a 240 widescreen finish for IMAX. But yeah, it's very exciting.
Would you have changed anything had you known it was going to be IMAX while you were filming?
Yeah, if I knew it was going to be IMAX while we're filming, I definitely would have composed for that taller ratio because I'm a huge fan of what Christopher Nolan's done in that world, for example, of, you know, mixing aspect ratios in IMAX or just embracing that taller aspect ratio. I love it. I kind of love all that headroom you get in Dunkirk, for example, above characters. I shoot a lot of medium format stills photography and I love that taller, more breathy headroom around people. So yeah, I definitely would have made sure that area was safe. But I think it reared its head in our post-production process so late that at that stage the film was pretty well cut and most of the visual effects had been done for the widescreen finish, and it was a little bit too late for us to explore whether our compositions worked across the whole film in that sense. So we decided to embrace just the widescreen finish.
In our last couple of minutes, I just want to talk about your kind of filmmaking philosophy, because I saw in a couple interviews of yours, you brought up two points that I wanted to mention here. One, and I'll let you elaborate on it, you gave some advice to aspiring filmmakers and you had said, you know, if you want to be a cinematographer, don't linger as an AC. But you still were encouraging them to be part of crew. Can you talk to us a little bit more on that and maybe even elaborate a little bit more on what your, you know, advice is to listeners here that are aspiring to be filmmakers at, you know, at your level?
Yeah, I guess no absolute disrespect to ACs at all, because that's totally perfect and path to take towards being a cinematographer as well. And a lot of great cinematographers have come from that path. I think it's fantastic to do your time there. Like I did my time. I don't think I was a very successful AC, but it meant that I got to work with admire and learn off a lot of cinematographers. I was lucky enough to kind of be a second AC briefly for Greg Fraser and Jermaine McMicking in Melbourne, Australia, and see them in their early days of work. You know, I got to work with Adam Arkapoor and Ari Wegner and see the way they worked. And so I learned a lot off watching other cinematographers work. But I probably learned the most when I actually started shooting, and whether that was short films and music videos, but I just got out there and shot as much as I possibly could. That worked for me because I was so insecure in my early days that I just needed as many hours on set as possible to break through that insecurity and get some confidence on set. Whereas other people, I feel like, maybe are a lot more confident with their choices and what they want to do, and they already might not need to do as much and can be a bit more discerning about their choices. For me, I was just like shooting anything and everything in my early days. I knew that every set I was on, I was going to learn something new, whether that was learning how to use a Steadicam by myself or learning how to use an underwater housing, learning how to shoot out of a helicopter, or, you know, every shoot was kind of teaching me something else. So for me, it was just those hours, getting those hours up.
We had Greg Fraser on the show for Lion, and he was also talking about Star Wars Rogue One too, but we had him on for Lion, and it's interesting. You guys definitely have a different kind of approach to filmmaking. It's becoming more and more like it is in the US, but there's something kind of like film purist with Australian filmmakers that I just love. I think it's your approach to filmmaking is just a little bit different than what I see in the US when I talk to, you know, American cinematographers. The last thing I wanted to talk to you about is one other thing that you mentioned in an interview that I watched of yours was the idea of being comfortable in natural light. And I think that is something that is so important for filmmakers, cinematographers in particular, is using natural light, because it happens so often. And having that skill, I just think, is so important. And I was glad to hear you talk about it. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so important to know when to light and when not to light, isn't it? Like, because you could be working in natural light in a house interior, for example, and then your light, you might think you need to light that scene and you might ruin it. So yeah. Well, one thing I find really interesting in pre-production is when you shoot stills of real locations, and when I print them, I'll be like, oh man, I better make sure I don't stuff up the natural light by overthinking it, because it actually looks quite beautiful how it is, or actually, how do I recreate that natural light so we can shoot the scene consistently for 8 hours? Or a quote I always remember from Emmanuel Lubezki, I remember him talking about Children of Men, how much of that film they shot in natural light. He said he couldn't have done a film like that early in his career. He had to have been at that stage of his career to have had the confidence to plan and shoot in that much natural light. I thought that was a really interesting thing to say, because even at that stage of his career, he was such a master. He'd done so many different things, but he had to be at that stage to have the confidence to lean on natural light so much. Because I guess there's a lot of pressure on set as a cinematographer to constantly control and shape and give the set consistency over time. So, yeah, it's an interesting push and pull between when to work in natural light and when not to. And it's often things you'll be asked in, you know, your final tech scouts a lot by first ADs and directors. When should we be here? You're constantly being asked, what time of day should we shoot at this location? And so you have to be very aware of natural light and what the sun path is to know how it'll affect a scene over time. So much of your planning needs to go into that.
Now, a lot of natural light in your film Jungle, of course, and you talked a lot about that as well. I, when you go into a film like Jungle, and you know you're going to be dealing with natural light, how are you planning those shots? I mean, the light moves so much in a day. How are you planning shots in order to take advantage of the quickly moving sun in your scenes?
Yeah, I guess trying to block shoot directions out, essentially. So you might be like, okay, in the morning we want to shoot towards east, so it's all backlit in the morning, and in the afternoon we'll try and shoot west. You can't always do that, but you generally might want to do that. So you're following the sun path throughout the day. In the middle of the day on Jungle, for example, we tried to be more undercover, under the canopy of thicker trees, so we didn't have the sun too harsh and top lit on our cast. But yeah, it's a constant battle. Sometimes you lose that battle and you're like, oh man, we just have to put up with this light, and I have to figure it out. Or you might, the thing that can hurt the speed of the production too, though, is you're like, you might get out a lot of hardware to try and match light. You might be getting out big scrims to take that hard light off the cast, and it slows the whole set down, and you're like, oh man, if only I planned this better, I could have shot this scene in more natural light with less hardware and it would have looked better and we would have had a flow going. So yeah, it's a constant battle. I remember hearing Faden Papamichael say once that he missed shooting smaller indie films because, you know, maybe on the films that I do, I can shoot entire scenes, you know, in an hour or two fast in good late light, whereas maybe on the bigger films it's harder to do that. You know, the cast might need more time, everybody needs more time. That so rather than shooting a whole scene at dusk, he has to shoot it over 10 hours and he can't take advantage of that beautiful natural light as much. He has to make it more consistent. So there's a good thing about these faster shoots where, you know, you might only have 35 days often, which I do on most of the films I do. They're like 35 day schedules.
Wow.
And, you know, you can go, okay, well, let's rehearse all afternoon and we know our coverage. Let's go in the good light and late in the day.
Last question. Is there a piece of gear or a tool or something that you have to have with you on every shoot?
I still use a light meter a lot, which crew often make fun of me about.
Why?
But I don't know. I think a lot of people still say, oh, what's that? They all joke like, yes. Why would you use that? But I still find it helps to keep my images really consistent, and it helps me keep track of light throughout the day, or studio lighting in particular, interior. It means like all my studio lighting matches throughout the day or days as a sequence goes on. Or for the motion control work in Invisible Man, it really helped because it just meant I could constantly check that all our plates were going to line up together light-wise. But yeah, I probably still travel around no matter where I shoot in the world with my light meter in my bag. I probably couldn't do a shoot without that. The other thing I know you said one, but the other thing I do, I travel around with a digital camera all the time, and I use that to visualize a film a lot. So that I use that just as much.
What are you traveling with now?
I've got a Canon 5D, which I know is really boring. It's not very sexy a camera these days, but it's such a workhorse.
Yeah.
And you know, I often travel with that and a Canon 1V, which is the last 35mm film camera Canon made. So it's sort of nice. I've got those two bodies and a few lenses, and I just travel around with those mostly.
Well, the film is called The Invisible Man. It's in theaters now. And Stefan, we are so happy that you came on to talk about your experiences. Of course, you have a whole bunch of other films in your portfolio. We'll put a link to your website, your IMDb. All of it will be there on gocreativeshow.com. Is there a Instagram you want to plug, a YouTube channel you want to plug, anything you want to plug before we go?
Oh, sure. I'm on Instagram. It's just my name, Stefan Duccio, if you look it up on Instagram. But that's about it. That's all. I'll just plug that.
Isn't that it? All this these days, it's all about Instagram, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's
I get a lot of contact about work on Instagram. I feel like it's a primary form of creative communication these days.
It's amazing. It's perfect for cinematographers. I'm looking at your profile right now. It's actually really beautiful. So lots of nice stuff here. And it's not just stills from your films. There's a lot of photography in here too. So yeah, this is give them a follow. This is a good one. I'll put it in the show notes as well. Stefan, thank you so much for being on Go Creative Show, and we'll have to have you back for your next big film.
Awesome. My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to thank Stefan Duccio for coming on the show to talk about his work on The Invisible Man. I learned a lot. I hope you guys did too, and I'd love to hear your comments. So find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and let us know what you think of this show and all the shows. We'd love to hear from our audience, especially if you have any suggestions on who we should have on next. I want to thank Matt Russell for mixing and mastering and making the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. And our producer, Connor Crosby, who makes it all happen behind the scenes here. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com, ignitionvisuals.com. And of course, if you want to know what I'm up to when I'm not doing Go Creative Show, well, it's easy. Head over to Instagram at Ben Consoli. I have been putting a lot of effort into my Instagram lately, so you get tons of behind the scenes. You get clips to my work. We have a brand new website at BC Media Productions. Yes, a brand new website. I'd love for you guys to check it out. bcmediaproductions.com. It's brand new. It took us forever to get that thing up. And I'd love your thoughts and comments. We like it, so I hope you do too. And lastly, I want to talk about our sponsors, PostLab, Stress-Free Collaboration for Final Cut Pro 10, and Rule Boston Camera, Buy, Rent, Create. At Rule, without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please support those that support us, and we will see you next week on another episode of Go Creative Show.